Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. There's a line in the musical Hamilton when the lead sings about the coming American Revolution. It's not a moment, it's the movement, is what the line is. Now, history will be the judge if this moment becomes a movement, but public revelations by women of sexual harassment, bullying, or even worse, have brought long overdue scrutiny, examination, and outrage over male behavior that ranges from boorish to criminal. Yes, the public attention has been dominated by high-profile allegations and admissions in the movie and media industry, certainly. Politics and the president have not been spared either. It's in every corner, from housekeepers to boardrooms, classrooms to offices. Sexual harassment is not just an issue of gender inequality. It intersects with issues of labor and issues of race. So how is this moment, this movement right now, translating across cultures here in South Florida? This is where we begin the Florida Roundup this week on WLRN. You can join the conversation, 800-743-WLRN, toll-free from across South Florida at 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet, your thoughts on the coverage of the silence breakers, as Time Magazine calls them, at WLRN is our handle on Twitter. Fabiola Santiago is a columnist for our partner, the Miami Herald. She's with us from our studios in Doral. Brenda Medina is a reporter from El Nuevo Herald with us in our downtown studios. First, let me acknowledge the obvious. I am a Generation Xer white guy, but this is a conversation that is happening everywhere. It is happening anywhere, and it is for everyone to share their stories and to listen to the stories. Fabiola, let me start. Do you think that this is more of a moment or a movement?
Good to be here with you, Tom. I do think that this is a movement. It's not just a moment, and it isn't going away. And I do think that there are women out there who still have stories to tell. And we're going to keep seeing this because men are going to continue to misbehave. And I think it's more than anything, it's a movement to educate.
Brenda, your thoughts on the moment that is happening now and the ability for this to become a movement?
Hi, Tom. And I truly hope it becomes a movement. It's very important. We're talking about things that we weren't talking so prominently about a year ago.
Right.
And
Six months ago.
Yeah. And we need to continue to talk about this.
So let's begin kind of getting into this, Fabiola, with your words this week in the column you wrote. Why did you decide this moment to put your voice into this movement?
Okay. Well, when the Harvey Weinstein story broke, my editor said, "Hey, you're going to write about Harvey Weinstein?" And I said, yeah, you know, and we started to have a little conversation. And then I was like, okay, you know, let's move on to another topic, right? And then...
was it discomfort with the topic?
Yes, yeah. Yes, but there I not admitted, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it was a very long process for me that lasted these 2 months because what it did, his first saying that... put the topic kind of on my plate in a way that I'm comfortable with, which is the professional one, right? Mm-hmm. My notebook, my pen has always been, you know, sort of my shield. And so, but that just didn't leave me alone. I didn't get around to it. There are many important issues in this community to write about and nationally. And so it evolved for me. And then on Tuesday... I was prepared to write about something. I had already done the work for another column. And then I heard, you know, a Republican congressman say that we had no right to judge Roy Moore and the Alabama voters.
Roy Moore is a judge in Alabama running for Republican Senate who's been accused of essentially pedophilia.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was it. I said, "You coward, just put everything aside." And I sat there and I wrote that column exactly as I felt it, experienced it, and as it had been working inside of me for the last 2 months.
Brenda, as you've begun reporting this in Spanish language media, in El Nuevo Herald, first, how has this been handled broadly in Spanish language media? And how does this... this moment of acknowledging this deep harassment and worse behavior. That is a unfair umbrella for much of these stories that, frankly, are criminal when we're talking about sexual assault and rape in some cases. But how does this cut across and intersect with cultures here in South Florida?
I feel that in English or Spanish, we haven't been reporting this, like localizing the story as aggressively as we should. I'm actually reporting on a story now about how this movement resonates with more vulnerable women, poor women, undocumented immigrants who work as caregivers or domestic workers and are subject to this kind of behaviors almost on a daily basis. I've written about domestic workers who at home are victims of domestic violence, and when they go to work are also victims of harassment, mistreatment, and violence. And I want to know, how do they deal with this? These are very traumatic experiences. They cannot go and write, you know, an essay that's going to come out in the cover of the New York Times. So how have they dealt with this historically, and how do they continue to deal with this after, like, hearing all over the news that powerful women are also have difficulties, you know, coming out and telling their stories?
Their predator, in their case, isn't a high-powered Hollywood producer, Fabiola, or a morning show, you know, television news mm-hmm. host, for instance.
Yeah. Yes. And that's education is one of the reasons that today I'm spending the day with you and with other people in the Spanish language, in Spanish language radio and some TV, to get the word out to those communities that Brenda is talking about. Brenda has done excellent work on the issue of domestic violence. Here's the issue. I think all communities have different dynamics, but at the same time, they're universal. I think the culture of silence has allowed this to go on for generations. I'm sure it is as old as mankind. And I think we need to break that. And that is what this is all about. In the Hispanic community, the culture of silence, which exists in, it exists in the United States. It exists in modern America mm-hmm. because abuse does not have an economic, it's not an economic issue. It's not an ethnic issue. It's not, it is across the board. But in our culture, I think that there's a double whammy of the culture of machismo and this culture of silence. And that is a deadly combination.
The culture of machismo and the culture of silence coming here in South Florida, talking about what Time Magazine has called the silence breakers. 800-743-9576 is our telephone number here on the Florida Roundup. It's 800-743-WLRN. You can line up the phone calls now. Speaking with Fabiola Santiago, columnist for our partner, the Miami Herald, and Brenda Medina, reporter for El Nuevo Herald. Brenda, talk to us about that collision of the culture of silence and the culture of machismo that Fabiola talks about.
Yeah, and more than that, it's also beyond the silence. Fabiola had a line in her column that was very powerful, because I have heard it over and over from many women in both, from the Dominican Republic, both like in my country and here. I don't want to tell my father because he would, you know, act very aggressively, like, you know, very probably violently towards the person who hurt me.
Yeah.
And I don't want my father to go to jail. That resonated so much because I've heard so many women throughout my life, ever since I was a teen, saying things like that. You don't say, you don't want to cause more problems, and that's very problematic. But there are also other cultural norms that are problematic, that are more subtle, that we are only starting to see and analyze as violence, as harassment, like the famous or infamous piropos in mm-hmm. Spanish,
yeah,
the no compliments. You know,
we call that catcalling, maybe in English.
Yes,
for instance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing a very powerful conversation taking place, at least in my country, in the Dominican Republic, where we have had campaigns about against domestic violence, against like killing women, which is so, like, obviously wrong, right, and a crime. But I see that now there are public campaigns, even politicians, public officials are starting to talk about maybe the root of these issues even deeper, and maybe it is rooted in the way we raise our kids, raise mm-hmm. our boys, mm-hmm. In the way that we tell them it is okay to catcall, you know, it is okay to do certain things, and it is, you know, the women's place to tell you they don't want it if they don't want it, but mostly they do want it. And nobody ever asked us if we did want it or not.
Yeah, many have pointed out that, you know, this is deep, Fabiola, as you talk about, it cuts across cultures, across class, across incomes, across generations and centuries for that matter, but gets to the heart of this concept of manhood for some reason comes with this idea of aggression and sexual pursuit at all cost. And it may start with a harassing comment and end in something that could be sexually criminal and really just awful behavior as well. But, and I want to talk about that campaign, Brenda, that you talk about in Latin America of focusing on domestic violence and violence against women, shifting that conversation. But Fabiola, Brenda picked up on something that I think a lot of people read in your column, which was the rationale that you had as a teenager hearing your father, as fathers do, express mm-hmm. that they will protect their children at all costs against any type of violence or any type of aggression, and how you rationalize that as a teenager into your action or what you now see as the inaction that you decided to take.
Exactly. Well, first I want to say that I had the most amazing parents. I had wonderful parents who sacrificed everything, brought me to this country, left their homeland, left everything behind, and were amazing, amazing parents. But they had this, there was this blind spot towards family, towards friends. And this is one of the things I want people to understand, that children are always listening to them. So are young people. Yeah. And our filters are not mature. They're not, you know, we understand at the level at which we were operating at that moment. And so, you know, we had a family friend who was had a very courageous little girl who said, you know, my cousin is touching me. And that family chose to very bravely, you know, call the police, prosecute, take it all the way to the end. The person was convicted and sent to prison. And I admired them. And when the discussion was happening in my home, my dad said, if anybody dares to touch my daughter, I will kill them. And the message that brought to me, what I felt being a sensitive child was, you know, or youth at that moment, was I don't want my father killing anyone. I don't want my father going to prison. And therefore, this set up the base for me to become the protector, which, by the way, I had also become in exile by learning English in 3 months and becoming their translator for this country. Mm-hmm. So it was a double whammy of, you know, now I also needed to keep them from protecting me. And so I was no longer the protected child. I was the protector of the peace, of family, of, you know.
Yeah.
And that plays out in relationships yep. later in life. Mm-hmm. It becomes a part of you. And it, you know, it plays out when your editor asks you to write about Harvey Weinstein.
As you shared with the community, Fabiola Santiago, columnist with the Miami Herald, is with us here on the Florida Roundup. Brenda Medina, reporter for El Nuevo Herald as well. Let's go to your phone calls, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. We'll begin in Fort Lauderdale with Marie. Marie, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts to this conversation. Marie, are you with us? You're on the radio.
Yes, thank you so much. Sorry, I didn't hear you prompt me. I just wanted to share that over the last couple of weeks, I've given this a lot of thought. So I went into my LinkedIn profile and I put an asterisk next to every position I've held. I'm 49 years old. I have an MBA. I've worked as an executive for the last several years. put an asterisk next to every position I've ever held where I've witnessed harassment or experienced it myself. And I've worked since I was 16. And I had an asterisk next to all but two jobs. Hmm. And as an executive, I just want to say that one of the finest moments for me professionally was putting a stop to harassment that was going on in the workplace and terminating an employee.
Marie, thank you for sharing your experiences with us here on the Roundup. We appreciate it. Thank you for your leadership.
Thank you.
Marie from Fort Lauderdale giving us her experiences. Nick is with us in Miami. Nick, thank you for holding on the telephone. You are live on the radio. Nick, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm about 50 years old, trying to do the right thing, but know that I don't know much about it. And so I wish there were some these experts could point us in a direction to where we could find out how not to harass people. I mean, not assaulting them is can handle that. But
all right.
You know, there's a lot of gray, and I don't want to be out there making people uncomfortable, but I think I'm probably missing a lot of stuff.
Nick, we appreciate it. We'll take you at your word there. Fabiola, Brenda, do you feel that there's gray area out there when it comes to language?
Yes, I'm happy to take. I'm happy to help them. Okay. One good way of measuring whether something is right or wrong is saying, would I be doing this to someone else? So, for example, if you think you're being nice or complimentary to me every time I come into work and you say, oh, you look so beautiful. Oh, don't, you know, do you comment on the appearance of the men in your workplace? Do you, when they come in, do you say, you look beautiful when they have a new outfit or haircut? Mm-hmm. And that, this is what, you know, this happens. And honestly, I take it as a friendly gesture, unless that advances. But I would think about it. I would think about having relationships with your coworkers on a, you know, we all want a professional workplace. You know, don't put your hands on their shoulders unless they're your very, very personal friends. You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of common sense, but I understand where there could be some confusion. Also, look, when a woman, you know, is interested in a man, you know it. You know it, just like I know when a man is interested in me.
Brenda, Nick brought up the idea of age, saying that he's in his 50s, and there has been some conversation nationally about generational changes. Harvey Weinstein made that initial statement now a few months ago about how mores had changed from the 60s and 70s when he was coming up in the Hollywood industry. Have they really? Have standards really changed in this, or it's breaking the silence is what has changed here?
I think it is the latter. I think the one thing that has changed is that we're speaking up and we're saying this is not right. I think that it wasn't right in the 60s and 50s either. And to Nick, I would say just if you have daughters or sisters or mothers, just like the limits test should be think about how you would want them treated. If you wouldn't do that to them, or if it would infuriate you that someone treats them in a certain way, why do you think it is okay to do it to other women? Just treat people as people and respect them.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go to Amy in Fort Lauderdale, who has been holding on the telephone. Amy, welcome. You're on the radio.
Yeah. Hey, thanks so much. So I just wanted to put in a little bit of a comment. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I specialize in sex and sexuality. And I feel as though so much of this has to do with the fact that, like, sexuality is this taboo thing that we don't talk about. Nobody talks about, like, appropriate sexual behavior. Very few times do we discuss this with our children in schools, in the workplace, because it's just people get the giggles or they don't want to talk about it or it's a religious thing. And I feel as though if we were talking more about how we're sexual beings and what healthy sexual behavior looks like, then maybe we would have less people acting inappropriately.
Amy, give us an opportunity to ask you, how do you start that kind of conversation? As someone who's licensed in this kind of therapy, how would you advise the South Florida community to have that conversation?
Well, I mean, first it's a matter of understanding that, we're sexual beings to begin with. We all have sex. That's how we got here, right? And we all have genitals and sexual body parts and things like that. And it's really just having a conversation in an open, honest, mature way and saying it's okay to giggle. It's okay to have questions. questions. It's okay to wonder and be curious. But let's talk about what is inappropriate and what's appropriate in conversations or behaviors related to our sexuality. Everybody's sexuality looks really different. And generally, in my opinion, anything is okay, sexually speaking, as long as the people who are participating are consenting. And when they're not, so we have to talk about what does consent look like. And when they're not consenting, what does that look like as well? And how can we gauge that? But it's just a matter of being able to say, sex and sexuality is normal. It's okay. Let's talk about it. Let's giggle. Let's whatever. So that we kind of get away from this cloud of it being a taboo concept. So that then nobody's feeling as though they need to lurk, you know, in the shadows or act in a deviant way, or if that makes sense.
Yeah. And also the idea of perception here in terms of understanding how your comments or actions may be interpreted based upon gender. And I suppose what I'm meaning, and this comes from our producer, about having that moral compass about how your actions are going to be interpreted, how your words are going to be interpreted, not based upon whether or not you have, as a male, a female in your life and how that woman or female would be impacted. There are objective moral guidelines here that aren't relative to whether or not you've got a mother or a daughter or a niece or a sister. They're absolute. They're not relative.
Yeah, I agree really quickly. I just want to say that it doesn't matter your gender necessarily. We're people. We're human beings. And it's a matter of how do you treat other people in an ethical manner and in a way that you'd want to be treated yourself. It doesn't matter if I'm a woman making sexually, you know, I can make sexually inappropriate passes and comments and make somebody feel, you know, uncomfortable based on my behaviors. I think it's beyond gender. I think it's just a matter of us as human beings and having that moral compass, like you said, to understand what people may or may not feel comfortable with.
Amy, we appreciate your words today. Thanks for joining us here on the Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Fabiola and Brenda, you both had comments as well.
Yeah, I'd like to say something important. I think Amy has excellent points, but I want to stress that sexual abuse and harassment is not about sex.
Right.
It's about power. It's about someone trying to overpower someone else or exercising their power over them. So, you know, to me, the sexuality is something awesome and amazing, and it has nothing to do with what we're really talking about here.
Brenda?
Yeah, I do think, however, that the education component that you was talking about is really important. If we keep treating certain topics, whether it's, you know, the power dynamics, machismo, or sexuality as taboo, we're never going to be able to have, you know, open and honest conversations about them. So we need to start addressing these topics at an early age, you know, openly and have healthy conversations about them.
Brenda, you mentioned earlier kind of campaigns in Caribbean countries and Latin American countries against domestic violence, against violence for women, and how this kind of Me Too moment in the U.S. may be changing that conversation, looking at the roots of that violence, beginning with workplace harassment or catcalling and those kinds of things. How's that conversation evolving?
Yeah, so I've seen in Argentina, Colombia, in the Dominican Republic, you know, the Caribbean, women taking to the streets with the hashtag or the chant, ni una más or ni una menos, so like not one more, not one less. And they're specifically talking about, like, men killing women, you know, whether it be
murder,
domestic violence or, you know, different scenarios, dating violence. But now the information, and I don't want to say this conversation just started there. That's, you know, part of my research. But I have noticed that even in mainstream media, something I haven't noticed before, the conversation has shifted to like the more subtle violence, sort of, not necessarily just like don't murder women, but teach your kids that catcalling might be offensive and women are not necessarily asking for it, and that's a type of violence too. And to see women and men, you know, on TV saying that, there is a news channel, Cadena de Noticias in the Dominican Republic, is actually running an entire campaign with their on-air talent talking about these things and saying, this is wrong, and we need to think about how we raise our boys. We need to think about how we teach them this power dynamics, and we need to tell them that it's not only hitting women is wrong, but also invading their personal space and catcalling them without them, you know, without you necessarily considering giving a thought to whether they feel comfortable or not.
Fabiola, will you be writing on this more?
Well, I did today. I wrote a column about how the Democrats are doing the right thing and the Republicans are still, you know, sitting on congressmen who we had one who just resigned, I think today or late yesterday.
A Republican congressman from Arizona.
From Arizona, right. But you know, we still have a president who is endorsing a Republican who essentially whose behavior was that of a pedophile, and you know, we have him in office, and you know, his sexual, the charges that he's, you know, faced, or the allegations, I should say, that he's faced, because he hasn't since faced any charges,
right.
But the allegations against him, you know, come from a lot of women, and women have written extensively. There was a during the campaign, a People magazine person who wrote about the time that you know, President Trump took her into a room in Mar-a-Lago and molested her, and you know, voters didn't pay attention to that, and that is a huge stain on this country. That is something that you know, has done a lot of damage, but at the same time, it has brought out the silence breakers. So you know, in essence, we'll be waiting for his, you know, resignation, I should say.
Fabiola Santiago, letting her thoughts be known there, certainly. Columnist for the Miami Herald. Fabi, thanks for joining us here on the Roundup this week. We appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Brenda Medina, reporter for El Nuevo Herald. Brenda, thank you for sharing your reporting with us as well. Appreciate
it. Thank
you. Still to come on our program. By the way, this conversation continues on Twitter. If you want to continue hearing and listening and joining that conversation, just look for our handle at WLRN. Still to come on the Roundup, for the third time in now almost 15 years, a local grand jury will investigate juvenile justice in the Sunshine State. Your experience with juvenile detention, let us know. Share it with our community. 800-743-WLRN as the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Honey bunning, sex, the lack of medical attention, just some of the abuses detailed 2 months ago in the Miami Herald's investigation into the state's juvenile justice system. So now, a Miami-Dade grand jury will conduct its own investigation. It's the third time in less than 15 years a local grand jury will look into the system of detention centers for 13 to 17-year-olds here in Florida. So what'll be different this time? Maybe you have experience in the juvenile justice system. Maybe you spent time there as a teenager or a parent or guardian, brother or sister, cousin who did. Share your experiences. Have you worked on the inside of one of these detention centers? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or send us a tweet at WLRN. Carol Marvin Miller is an investigative reporter for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us again. She was the driving reporter behind Fight Club, the investigative series, 2 months ago. Carol, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
What will this grand jury focus on?
Well, it's hard to say with any specificity because grand juries operate in secret. That's under state law. And so prosecutors were not able to talk with us about what exactly they anticipate they'll present to the grand jury and which witnesses will appear. But we do know that they are acting in response to the series that we published a couple months ago. They are interested in the conditions within which children are housed in these facilities. They want to look at the pervasiveness of violence. They want to look at, I would imagine, excessive and unnecessary force, medical neglect, sexual misconduct. And this crazy thing we wrote about called Honey Bunning, in which officers and youth workers offer kids pastries and other treats to beat up other kids.
Will this grand jury be focused exclusively on juvenile justice, or could other issues be put in front of it? Is it being embattled just to look at this specific issue?
No, the way grand juries work is you impanel grand juries, I want to say every 6 or 9 mm-hmm. months. And their primary responsibility is indicting homicide cases in homicide cases. Other than that primary responsibility, there are other things they can do. And in Florida, and particularly in Miami-Dade County, there's a very long tradition of grand juries being asked to investigate social ills, government problems, and issue reports that are called presentments. The Dade grand jury has looked at juvenile justice a number of times, going all the way back to the 1950s.
Yeah, 1955, I think you mentioned in your report in the last day or so, was the first time
right.
a Dade County grand jury looked at juvenile justice. That's how long the top prosecutor in the county has been curious about what's been going on in these detention centers.
Right. With regard to modern history in Florida, the grand jury that is most crucial to this discussion was that grand jury in 2003, which looked at the death of a youth by the name of Omar Paisley. Mm-hmm. Omar was incarcerated for getting in a fight in Opa-locka. He had been in the lockup for some time when he developed appendicitis, and it was allowed to progress because though Omar had pleaded with officers and nurses to get him to a doctor, they were convinced he was faking, and they refused to get him medical care. And Omar died a cruel and excruciating death of a burst appendix.
The 2003 grand jury investigation included this line, that the grand jury was, quote, appalled at the utter lack of humanity demonstrated by many of the detention workers charged with the safety and care of our youth, end quote. That was 2003. As you documented the abuses in youth detention centers in 2015, 2016, do you think that accusation, that conclusion by the 2003 grand jury has been answered?
No. I want to say that DJJ, the Department of Juvenile Justice, is like any agency. There are obviously hundreds, thousands of decent, hardworking, compassionate men and women who work there and care for young people. There are also, we found, a disturbing number of officers and youth workers who don't seem to have the same level of empathy that you would like to see. And that manifested itself in a variety of ills, including this crazy thing of deputizing kids and turning them into goons. And that's what killed the kid named Elward Revolt, who was beaten to death in August of 15.
For standing up to grab a carton of milk, I believe it was.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Against a guard's orders.
And that remains kind of an open question.
Okay.
The state attorney's office investigated Elward's death, as did the Miami police. And there was evidence that an officer on duty that night had provoked the attack that killed Elord. The prosecutors who investigated that case found that evidence, but also concluded that there wasn't enough of it to charge anyone.
The Department of Juvenile Justice, in its initial response to your reporting 2 months ago, Fight Club, talked about these incidents, these separate, isolated incidents. Am I right in that?
They called them. They did not use the word isolated incidents, the words, but clearly their take is that there is no pattern.
Right.
This is not a practice that has taken hold. That was not what we found.
Right. You found counter to that.
When we looked at this system as a whole, we obtained and we viewed thousands and thousands of pages of records. And we found examples of honey bunning all over the state of Florida, in Jacksonville, in Tampa, in Okeechobee, in Dade County, Broward County. And the allegations that surfaced were consistent and similar across jurisdictions. The officers who did this used the same language. They would say, there's a honey bun on his head. The kids would refer to the violence that ensued as a honey bun hit or a kid being honey bunned. And it's telling when you see the same language, the same details occur across jurisdictions in the state and across time, going all the way back probably 20 years.
What has been the reaction by the state, specifically lawmakers, to this? There have been some lawmakers who have decided to visit some of these juvenile justice detention centers. Tell us about those visits.
Lawmakers in Dade County were the first to walk into a lockup. Now, under state law, they don't have the authority to make a surprise inspection. But to her credit, the Secretary of the Department of Juvenile Justice, Christy Daly, allowed them to do so. And so they took a tour in Miami, and they came out and they told one of our reporters that they were pretty shocked. I believe the quote was horrible, horrific, deplorable, right, or something like that. A few weeks after that, lawmakers in Broward County took a tour of that facility. There's some question as to whether that visit was a surprise or not. Their findings were similar to what lawmakers said in Dade. Now, after those visits and after those quotes, we started pulling records. And it's likely that their observations were correct. The superintendent in Miami-Dade was reprimanded for failing to maintain that facility adequately. And after that, there was a memo that went out statewide in which a deputy secretary said, here's what we have to do from now on. Fix your toilets, fix your showers, paint over the graffiti, make sure the plumbing works. We were interested in that. We pulled some additional records. We found that in Manatee County, there had been a persistent problem with the plumbing. A couple of months ago, there was a sewage leak mm-hmm. that rendered a couple of the living areas unsuitable. There was an outbreak of lice that they had trouble treating because some of the showers weren't working. So I think that there's now going to be an emphasis in better maintaining the places where these kids live.
Talking about the juvenile justice system in the state of Florida, Carol Marvin Miller, the investigative reporter for our partner, the Miami Herald, behind the series Fight Club, which has led to the top prosecutor in Miami-Dade County to announce a grand jury investigation into juvenile justice. You can join our conversation, 800-743-9576. Maybe you've had experience with juvenile justice in Florida. What was that like? 800-743-WLRN. Carol, will the grand jury, and I know a lot of it obviously happens in secret, that's the whole point of a grand jury, but will it be limited to looking at Dade County juvenile justice?
No, I don't think so. In 2011, after Omar's death in 2003, the Miami-Dade grand jury decided to take another look. And that was in the wake of another controversial death in West Palm Beach, in which a youth by the name of Eric Perez died, also of medical neglect.
Head injuries, I think it was.
He was dropped on his head by an officer. He also begged for medical care and didn't get it. And he died from a head injury. And Miami-Dade decided to take a look and try to answer the question, was any of this fixed after our first presentment? And they found that there had been some progress, but in several areas there had been a lack of progress. the point is, I don't think the top prosecutor in Miami is shy about looking at this system as a state problem and not just what goes on at the lockup in Miami-Dade.
Given, Carol, this is the third grand jury investigation by a Dade County grand jury into juvenile justice in less than 15 years, what should be different this time? What could be different this time?
Well, I think that you have a DJJ secretary who is reform-minded, and I think that she would like to see some additional progress, and I think she has a willing partner in the governor. The problem is nobody in state government has ever wanted to spend what is necessary to truly reform this system. The buildings in which these kids are housed are extraordinarily old. They're decades old. Some of them are crumbling. The plumbing isn't working. Yeah. The governor has asked for 11 million, give or take, new dollars right. for maintenance. But that's not going to be close to enough. I want to say one additional thing. The other issue that we found that was pervasive was the quality of employees. The private providers who run the residential facilities yeah. are paying about $19,000 a year. They're getting high school grads with GEDs. That's not the kind of staff that you want to truly rehabilitate these kids.
Let me bring in Mike from Miami, who is on the phone. Mike, you say that you have spent some time in one of these facilities?
Unfortunately, yes. I was 15 years old. I did something very stupid, and I had to spend some time there. Let me tell you, it's just deplorable. I remember at 15 years old, I was wearing a size 14 shoe. They didn't have shoes that fit me, so I ended up having to walk around barefoot the entire time. Huh. It was horrible. The laundry smell, I mean, I've never been to adult prison, but I want to imagine it's better than that, you know?
Did you feel in danger while you were there, Mike?
Yeah, I did.
And
they put me
in danger.
They put me in a one.
In danger. In danger from whom?
Well, they put me in a one-person cell with two people in there. I ended up having to sleep on the floor, and the guy I was in with, I had something drug related, and he was in because he stabbed a classmate.
I'm curious about this, given your experience and the treatment that you received. How did that play into efforts to rehabilitate you and to make you a better citizen?
Yeah, there was no rehabilitation whatsoever. It was just go here, do your time, and then leave and never come back.
Hmm. Mike, thanks for sharing your experiences with us. We appreciate it. Thanks.
No problem. Thank you.
Carol, what's the timeline for this grand jury? Do we know?
Well, the grand jury was just impaneled. It's 2 or 3 weeks old, not more than that. I don't think there will be a great deal of testimony over the Christmas holidays. I think probably come the new year, you'll see more of an effort to get that grand jury started. And I would imagine, given the complexity of the issue that they're studying, that it will continue to look at this until their term ends.
6 or 9 months, so middle of next year.
I would think
2018,
so.
Yeah. Carol Marvin Miller, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Always great to have you on the program, Carol. Thanks
so much. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. More to come on the Roundup. Pine Rockland used to cover thousands of acres in South Florida. That's next as the Roundup continues. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. This week, a new shopping mall, parking lot, and apartment complex in South Dade County took one more step toward reality. Normally, such a step for really a seemingly conventional real estate development would barely register, but this time it involves a slice of a rare forest, a stretch of rock pineland forest in Dade County. Jenny Stiletovich covers the environment for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our studios in Doral. Jenny, welcome back to the Roundup. Nice to have you.
Hi. Thanks, Tom.
Describe the site that is the focus here.
So this is about 83 acres of pine rockland forest spread about across about 138 acres near Zoo Miami. It was once part of a large naval blimp base that was decommissioned and then the thing sort of carved into parcels. Some was given to the county where the zoo was built. Larry and Penny Thompson Park covers mm-hmm. another part. The Department of Defense has a site in there. And then the University of Miami was given a couple of tracks. With the caveat that it be used for educational purposes.
And then the developer comes in and purchases it from the University of Miami. Coral Reef Commons is the name of this development. A little retail, a little residential. How much pine rockland is involved?
83 acres.
And how much will be left if the development is built as planned as it sits right now in blueprints?
About 50, but it'll be carved up. Their plan is to put all the development, the shopping, the strip mall, and the apartments and the parking lot sort of in the center. And then on either side will be two smaller preserves that are about 20-plus acres each. And then they have something called a wildlife corridor, mm-hmm. which is basically like a pathway along the edge of the property that connects the two parcels.
What lives? Preserves. Yeah, what lives in this space now in these forests?
Well, the reason why the forest is so globally imperiled is it used to cover, you know, all of the high ground in South Florida.
Yeah, which the Miami Ridge, right?
Yeah, which right. is where, you know, City of Miami, Kendall, all that stuff now covers what was once this rockland. It's shrunk so dramatically that the animals and plants that live in it, you know, have no more habitat. So many of them are critically endangered and are, you know, listed on the endangered species list. They include butterflies. There's two butterflies that are in there. The Florida bonneted bat, which is one of the largest bats, one of the few that you can actually hear because mm-hmm. its frequency is so low. There's a couple of snakes in there. There's a host of little herbaceous plants that live because the forest floor, what makes it so unique is it's basically our oolitic limestone. So it's yeah. all pocked with little crevices.
And scrubby kind of land is right. a way to think of it. What about the environmental value here? As the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service looked through these plans, they had to sign off on a conservation plan. How do they kind of put a value to it, figure out how to do this parcel split into these acres?
Right. That's part of the dispute over this habitat conservation plan that they approved because they allowed the developers, consultants to come up with their own formula. And it was kind of a complicated thing called a habitat assessment functionality that was new, and it's not been peer reviewed. I guess I'll be breaking news here. Maybe
okay.
the four environmental groups filed a lawsuit this morning to overturn the decision and also ask for an emergency injunction to stop work that began the day after the Wildlife Service approved the plan.
And we haven't heard from a judge in that request yet, have we?
They just filed it this morning.
Morning, gotcha. Yeah. So they've got this kind of environmental valuation that has been untested, as you mentioned, and not peer-reviewed. The decision by Fish and Wildlife, at least initially, allowed, you know, if bulldozers wanted to start work, they could have started work, right, Jenny?
Yes. I mean, they allow it, and then the county already approved the project.
Right.
The county months ago said, and the developer agreed that they would hold off work until they got these approvals from the Fish and Wildlife Service.
And they got that this week, so that essentially was the green light.
Correct.
Until potentially this court request that you're reporting on right now that came just a few hours ago to ask for an emergency injunction.
Right.
Yeah. Let's presume for a moment all of this continues to move forward as it's in the blueprints right now. How much pine rockland will be left in Dade County?
There is, it's between 1 and 2% outside Everglades National Park
yeah.
Of what used to, you know, be a huge area. I think it's, I'm sorry, I don't know the exact number. It's over 2,000 acres, but under 3,000 acres.
Okay, somewhere between 2 and 3,000 acres left and about 50 in this particular parcel
right,
of
and,
land here.
And most of what's left is highly fragmented. There are little bits here and there. Like I said, Larry and Penny Thompson Park is one of the biggest tracks left.
Jenny Stiletovich, environmental reporter for a part in the Miami Herald. Jenny, always a pleasure to have you on the Roundup. Thanks for sharing the reporting with us.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
That'll do it for the Roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Digital editor is Teresa Frontato. WLRN's news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director, Peter J. Meritz, our program director, and our technical supervisor today is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, thanks for tweeting, and thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.